This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we're going to talk about Lost in Space. We're going to have an interview today with Mark Cushman, who has written a book called Irwin Allen's Lost in Space. It's a definitive volume. And when I say a definitive volume, this is an amazing book. And this is just volume one. We got two more to look forward to. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, David. How are you?
Hi. Are you? I wonder who likes Lost in Space more, me or you?
Well, you've read the book. You tell me.
Yeah. Well, I think you.
I love Lost in Space. You know, I was probably 9 or 10 when it premiered, or maybe even 8.
I was 3.
And it was a year before Star Trek, so it really just captured my imagination. That first season was kind of dark and film noirish, at least the first a dozen episodes or so, and I just loved it. And of course, in fall of '66, Star Trek came on, so we all swung over there. But I still watched Lost in Space every week. It was changing, but it was so colorful and so imaginative and so unique. There was no other show like Lost in Space. And one of the things that caught me about it, that as I wrote the books, I realized what it is about that show that keeps the fans lined up, is it's the family. You know, seeing a family together, the whole Swiss Family Robinson aspect, and putting them out there in outer space, and so you could watch the show with your family when you were a kid, and imagine your own family out there, and empathize and relate to these people. And it gets under your skin. It worked its way into our hearts.
When you look at the very first picture in the book with the cast picture, everybody in the cast was photogenic. I mean, there's not one person that doesn't take a good picture.
Well, Irwin Allen had a great knack for putting together all-star casts. And when you read that first volume, first of all, we give you an entire background on Irwin Allen, which nobody's ever done before. So you find out his rags-to-riches story and how he self-made himself all the way up, and had hit movies and then did Voice on the Sea and then did Lost in Space and was really going into new territory. He truly was the guy who went where no man had gone before and made Star Trek possible, really. But getting back to your comment, he would put together these all-star casts. He did it in The Lost World, which was a big hit movie for him a few years earlier, and, mm-hmm. and the Voice on the Sea movie, even the TV show. David Hedison had been a star. He'd had a series of his own called The Five Fingers. Richard Basehart was, of course, a huge star in movies and on stage. And with Lost in Space, he took Guy Williams, who was Zorro. Everybody knew Guy Williams. June mm-hmm. Lockhart had just done seven years, I think, on Lassie, and had an amazing career before that on stage and in films. Angela Cartwright, of course, was in Make Room for Daddy
right.
for 7 years, and Sound of Music she had just finished. Mark Goddard, a lot of people didn't know, but you find this out reading the book. 3 series. You know, he started with Johnny Ringo, and then he was in The Detectives with Robert Taylor, and then he had a third show, a sitcom with Eleanor Donoghue, and the name of it escapes me right now, but it's right there in the book.
Right.
And who are we forgetting? Marta Kristen was fairly new on the scene, but she had already starred in a movie for Disney. She'd been doing a lot of TV, a lot of print ads and commercials, so she was a very familiar face on television. And then, of course, Jonathan Harris.
Oh, my God.
Well, let's not forget Billy Mumy. My God. I mean, Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock, everything. And then Jonathan Harris had been in 2 series, the Third Man with Michael Renee and the Bill Dana Show with Bill Dana and Maxwell Smart, Don Adams. And he played this fussy hotel manager, and he kind of incorporated a lot of those characteristics into Dr. Smith. So Irwin would do these all-star casts. We saw him do it decades later with Tower and Inferno and Poseidon Adventure. So he really loaded it up with people that everybody knew back then. In 1965, you turned on that show, you knew all these people. This was truly an all-star TV cast, and very photogenic, as you said.
Right. And that's one of the great things about the book is these old pictures of them. Like, here's one, Mark Goddard and Johnny Ringo. And, you know, they're so identified with Lost in Space, it's hard to see them in something else and say, wow, I didn't even know they did that. You know, our mind goes right to Lost in Space because it was such an iconic TV show, you know, and it's still on the air today.
Well, you know, that's what I do in these books, and I did one on I Spy, which was a very important show in that period. A lot of people have forgotten. Big hit, but it was the first show to put a white and a black together on equal status. The
right.
First time a black actor won an Emmy, Bill Cosby, 3 years in a row. The first show to shoot around the world and invented a lot of technology to do it. And I did that 3-book set, These Are the Voyages on Star Trek. And what I do with all these books is I take you back. We're not looking back. I take you back in time, and because it's interesting to me to know who these people are, even the guest stars. You know, we see them now, and then we go, oh, that's a familiar face. I think he did a lot of TV. But these people had very, very good resumes and were top guest stars, and, of course, the people in the cast were top stars of that time. I think it's interesting to find all that stuff out so you understand the significance of the casting and everything else they did in these shows.
Exactly. It just has a place in my heart. It always will, because of the fact that when I was growing up, it was such a big part of my life. It was such when you're younger, I was 3 when the show was on the air, so I really didn't watch the first run episodes. I didn't watch it till later. But even then, you know, being as a kid, you know, it just was so overwhelmingly, and this is before we have all the stuff we have today, but back then it was something big. I mean, you compare it to what's on today, and it isn't the same, but it's still, with the music, with the cast, with the...
Oh, the music was fantastic. That's John Williams who did the...
The John Williams. I didn't realize it was the same John Williams.
Yeah, because he was named Johnny Williams back then. He was a very young composer, and he did... the title music, and he did scored the first few episodes, which kind of set the foundation for the music that you would hear throughout the series. He wrote the second theme song for the 3rd year when they changed the entire sequence and went with a new theme. And very talented people all down the line. You know, and anyone who did see it when it first came on, or watch it now on Blu-ray, those first 5-6 episodes
are amazing.
Series,
yeah.
Are just epic for television. I mean, Irwin Allen, when he moved from feature films into TV, and the reason he did it, his movies were hits, but he was under contract with 20th Century Fox. He was doing all of his movies through them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had suddenly fallen on hard times because of Cleopatra, which they were in the process of making, which went way over budget with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, and it was just an immense, they were hemorrhaging money. And like you couldn't believe. And at the same time, they were making the last Marilyn Monroe movie, which they never finished because she died halfway into it. And so 20th Century Fox was suddenly in debt. They had to sell off their back lot, which made 20th Century City here in L.A. And so their filmmaking unit was crippled. So Irwin was a workaholic. So he said, well, if I can't make movies, I'm going to make TV. And so he went into television with Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and you read the big chapter on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea in this book.
Yeah.
And what's really significant about that, and this kind of feeds into how Star Trek got on the air as well, is in 1964, when he did Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, the networks did not believe that a science fiction series of that type could attract a mass audience, because there had really only been 2. There had been The Outer Limits and Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And back in the 50s, you had Captain Video, but those were very cheaply done and in the afternoons just for the kiddies. But Outer Limits failed in the ratings, only lasted a year and a half on ABC. Twilight Zone went for 6 seasons, but it never did well in the ratings. It was on late Friday nights on CBS, and the reason the network kept it on is because Rod Serling would win Emmys every year for his scripts. So it was kind of a prestigious show for them, but it never found its audience until it went into syndication.
Mm-hmm.
So when Irwin came into ABC with the idea of doing Voyage, they laughed at him. They said, nobody's going to watch this, and even if they were to, you couldn't do this on a TV budget. You couldn't deliver these episodes on time, having to do photographic effects and these big miniatures of the sea view and all that stuff. And the way he got it on, as you know from reading the book, was he said, look, I did a movie, and I saved everything. I saved the miniatures. We have three of them. One's 24 feet long. We've got the tanks that we filmed them in. We've got all the costumes. We've got the props. We've got everything. We've even got footage, stock footage of the ship that we never used in the movies. And you can have all that for free. And I'll do this on a TV budget, and I'll do it on schedule. And he did. So the following year, CBS is getting kicked by Voice of the Sea. It's a big hit. So they called him in and said, give us one. And he said, I want to do Swiss Family Robinson in Outer Space. And they said, okay. Well, here's the interesting thing. The Voyage pilot was the most expensive pilot ever made up to that point. It cost $450,000, which today would be...
Oh, my God, that's a lot.
Yeah, today would be about $4 million. And which today they spend on stuff, but back then, no, not at
that's
all.
It's amazing they spent the money knowing they didn't know it was going to be a success.
Yeah, it was 20th Century Fox really stuck their neck out on this, and so did ABC. So it's such a huge hit now that when he did the Lost in Space pilot, it cost $550,000. Now, it's the most expensive pilot ever made. Mm. 1 year later, or really at the same time, Desilu is making a pilot for Star Trek for NBC, and it costs over $600,000. Make actually close to 700,000.
Right.
So science fiction, you can see that the networks weren't being it's not that they weren't visionary, it's just that they knew the realities of television, and they knew that, you know what, you cannot create whole new worlds and do it on a TV budget. We can do hospital shows and cop shows and lawyer shows because you use standard sets, standard costuming, westerns. There were westerns everywhere, and they had plenty of movie ranches for westerns, and so those were cheap to make. But how do you create these futuristic worlds and shoot all these photographic effects? Well, Irwin did it. And because he did it, that's what made NBC say, we got to have one too, and that's why they went with Star Trek for the fall of 1966.
How about that?
So Lost in Space was really crucial to Star Trek becoming a reality, and Star Trek is the most popular TV franchise in the history of television.
Well, it makes you wonder what cost so much in the pilot, because it wasn't the actors. They weren't making all that much money compared to what the budget was anyway.
The photographic effects is the big thing. You know, now you can do it all on computers. Back then, you had to do it the old-fashioned way, and they were extremely expensive to do and very time-consuming. But also, you had to build these miniatures. You had to do all the costuming. You know, you couldn't just go to Western Costume and say, I'll take that cowboy outfit. Everything had to be created from scratch. And when they did Star Trek, they had to build the Enterprise inside and out, and all these things cost money, but they take time. It would take Star Trek was particularly hard because the Enterprise was 11 feet 2 inches long. It was mounted on a pole, with flashing lights and everything, up against a green screen, and the camera would track past it. Nobody had ever done that before. And later on, they use that technique for Star Wars and everything else. But it would take an entire day to do one flyby of the Enterprise. And if the camera jiggled once during that entire day, it would only move a fraction of an inch at a time. If it jiggled just once, and they wouldn't know until the next day when they looked at the film after it was processed, they had to throw it all out, and they had to do it all over again.
Oh, that's crazy.
So it would take weeks and weeks to get these effects done for one episode. So the networks are thinking, then how are you going to deliver an episode every week? How are you going to do half a science fiction movie every week for television? Now, with computers, you can do it. Back then, it was a whole different thing. So Irwin Allen was a true TV pioneer, and he proved that it could be done, which made it possible for Star Trek to come on the air and so many things after that. And he's never really gotten his due. So when we did these books, and I say we because I've had a lot of support from my publisher and my editor, Mark Alford.
I don't know how you got all these pictures. I mean, these pictures are amazing. I mean, you can...
Well, the book is authorized through... Kevin Burns, who is the shepherd of Lost in Space and all the Irwin Allen properties, and so he gave us these pictures out of his collection there that were taken when the show was on. So that first book that you're holding has what, over 400 pictures in there, all high resolution. Half of them have never been seen before, and the stuff coming up in Volume 2 and Volume 3 is going to blow you away.
Really? Looking at the scene from the pilot where with the ostrich, Billy Mumy chasing the ostrich. Was that even in the show?
Briefly. If you blink, you're going to miss it. But
was it really in the pilot somewhere?
Oh, in the pilot, they were featured a little more prominently. And if you get the Blu-ray set, you can watch the original pilot, and you'll see the ostriches. But in the actual series, you know, they used footage from the pilot in those first 5-6 episodes and spread them out. And you see the ostrich in one scene, and as I said, if you blink, you're going to miss it. But the reason they didn't keep the ostriches, well, first of all, the reason they had them was because Swiss Family Robinson had them.
Okay.
They were doing Swiss Family Robinson in outer space. The reason they didn't keep them on is because they're very difficult animals to work with, and Billy Mumy couldn't stand them. You know, Billy Mumy couldn't stand the ostriches. He said they spit at him. They were just vile creatures, and he was scared to death of them as a little boy. And so they said, okay, this isn't going to work. I mean, they're trying to do almost the impossible as it is and keep on schedule.
Now, what about...
The last thing they need is anything that's going to slow them down.
Right. What about this thing with Dr. Smith? Now, I mean, he took over the series, basically. I mean, to a certain extent, he became a central part to the series. But was there resentment with the other people when he did that?
Of course. And you know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write these books. Not just because I loved the show as a kid.
He became the Fonzie of Lost in Space. I mean, he was the center of attention.
Nobody had ever really answered the question as to why the show changed and how everybody felt about it and so forth. And the show was a hit. Now, when you have a hit show, why do you change it? Why did they go from serious science fiction to kind of comedy fantasy?
Exactly.
Why did they take the villain and make him the primary character when they had these other huge stars and make them secondary roles? I mean, what was the reasoning behind all that?
And it had to make them angry, all the cast members.
Yeah. I needed to know. So I went and I had access to all the show files, all the documents, and interviewed everybody I could get and had archival interviews. And we reconstructed the story so that you find out why all this happened. And as you know from reading that first book, you know, even though the show was a hit, the minute it came on, it was winning its time slot. But it was on during the family hour. And this is 1965, whole different world. And you couldn't do things during the family hour that you could do, say, at 8:30 or 9:30 at night on the networks. And CBS was very, very bothered by the fact that every week this homicidal character named Dr. Smith was putting the children in peril.
Oh, yeah.
Not just through his bungling behavior as it was in later seasons, but in the originals episodes, the first episodes, he was trying to kill everybody. He was programming the robot to kill the family, including the children. And the network said, we don't care how big of a hit this show is. You cannot do this. Get rid of him. And dismantle the robot. And Irwin didn't want to lose him, so he said, well, what if we change him? Bit by bit, episode by episode.
So if the network had gotten their way, Dr. Smith would have been gone.
Right. And you notice...
And then Irwin Allen wanted to fire him, too, apparently, at one point.
Well, there was one day when he just got upset. He said, I'm going to get rid of him. And one of his directors, Don Richardson, said, you can't do that. He's the whole show. But you know, Jonathan was billed as a special guest star because it was never decided if they were going to keep him or not. There was another reason he had the special guest star billing is because when they brought him in after the pilot was made, all the other stars were already contractually guaranteed top billing, second billing, third billing, so forth. So he was going to be given seventh billing. And he said, I just had two TV series. I can't take seventh billing. So he said, I need some kind of special billing if my name's going to come up. And they didn't think they were going to keep the character anyway, so they made him a special guest star. Well,
you know what? One of the standouts of this book, and I should mention, is from Jacob Brown Press, right?
Jacobs Brown. Uh-huh.
Jacobs Brown. Okay. Well, there's an S on the end. is that you actually tell us what the stars were making. And I'm like, you'd never see that in a book.
And, yeah.
Except Dr. Smith. I don't think his salary's listed, is it?
No, it is. It is.
I didn't see that one. Okay.
And by the second season, he's making more than Guy Williams, who was supposed to be the top
billing. Is that right? Oh, well, that must have made Guy pretty upset. But
Guy had his top billing, but he wasn't making as much money, and he wasn't on the screen as much as Jonathan Harris was.
You never know it by the episodes. The episodes were always, I mean, it was always good in every episode. I think of the Antimatter Man. That's one of my favorite episodes.
Excellent. Excellent episode. Third season. Yeah.
Very, and very creepy. Even today watching it, you get creeped out by it. I mean, there's the thought that there's a doppelganger of all of us somewhere in another world is...
Well, and the acting is so fantastic. I mean, Guy Williams, even though he was such a likable character and made such a great dad and...
The voice alone just was so...
He played that part dark, and he's spooky in that episode.
Yeah.
Mark Goddard does a wonderful job, too, as the Major West. It was very frightening for the kids. And so they would sneak in episodes like that every now and then, but for the most part, they had to keep the show lighter.
So who was getting the most fan mail during the run of the series, do you know?
The robot.
The robot?
Yes.
The robot got the most fan mail.
followed by Jonathan Harris, followed by Billy Mumy.
And there's a story in here with Jonathan Harris where somebody was hissing at him at a restaurant. It's a great little story.
Yeah, some teenagers were at another table and they looked over and started hissing at him, and so he hissed back.
That's what's so great about your book, Mark. There's so many different stories in this book, so much, and you can go back over and over and over and just read them again and again, and the pictures. I mean, you look at some of them, you're like, oh my God, I've never seen that person with that person before, you know? Here's one of them reading the Hollywood Reporter, and it's Judy.
Yeah, and we give every episode its own chapter, and as you know from looking through there, you were mentioning the salaries. Well, you know the budget of every episode. You know how many days it took to film. What days it was filmed, where it was filmed, what went right, what went wrong.
It's amazing.
You know, it's like you're sitting there watching each episode being made, and then you can watch them again and see them in a whole new light.
And you know, when you think of Dr. Smith, and despite the fact he was an awful, awful man, and what he did, he endangered practically everybody on the crew at one point or another. But... You know, but he, there's a lasting impression. You can't help but think of him when you think of the show and what he did for the show. I mean, but you have to laugh, too, because it was funny.
Yeah, and Jonathan Harris had done hundreds of roles before he played Dr. Smith.
You think that was his favorite role?
Oh, absolutely. He said that. And we have exclusive interviews with him that are in these books that were taped shortly before he died and had never been released. And so you see, especially when we get into books 2 and 3, you're going to see lots and lots of things from him that you had never heard before, where he's revealing stuff.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But what happened, which is the same thing that happened with a lot of the people on Star Trek and other shows that become such massive hits, is that they become typecast. So he had hundreds of roles before Lost in Space, but after Lost in Space, anytime you'd look at him, you'd say, Dr. Smith.
I think he was on Bewitched at one point, too.
Yeah, he did a couple Bewitched after Lost in Space. He did a Land of the Giants. He worked, but he mainly got into voiceover work and did a lot of voices in cartoons.
That's what happens when you're so good, you get typecast.
Yeah, because he grew a mustache after the show went off to try to change his look a little bit, because he was just so identified with that character now. And same thing, you look at somebody like James Doohan in Star Trek, you know, he didn't have a Scottish accent, and he probably did 50, 60, 70 different roles before Star Trek, easy, and afterwards, people would only call him if they wanted somebody with a Scottish accent.
That's funny.
He said, look, you know, I'm from Canada, you know, I made that accent up, but he was so identified with the character of Scotty that's it for the rest of his career.
That's fascinating. Now, how many of the cast did you actually interview for the book?
I interviewed Bill Mumy. I interviewed Angela Cartwright, Marta Kristen.
Marta Kristen was just in Phoenixville, in my area here, in July. I wanted to go see her.
I'm doing a show with them in late Halloween weekend up in Santa Clara.
They just seem like really nice people. Angela, I've talked to before. She's a sweet person.
And you know, here's an interesting thing about them, which you'll find out in book three, because it not only covers book three, not only covers the third season, but everything that happened after, all the various cast reunions for conventions, the movie from New Line Cinema, the attempts to bring Lost in Space back to TV, including a couple TV pilots, one with the original cast, and so forth, and now the new Netflix series, which is going to premiere next year.
Do we know who's going to be in that yet? Do we know anything about that?
They're casting right now, and what I found out is they are truly a family. They really love each other. They would get together for lunch once a month for years over at 20th Century Fox in the Shirley Temple Room. I mean, they really became a family. Yes, there was resentment on the part of June Lockhart and Guy Williams and even Mark Goddard about the fact that Jonathan suddenly had a bigger role than they did, which was not the way it was supposed to be. But they never disliked him as a person. How could you dislike him? He was such a delightful person.
I saw him at a convention, and one of the best speakers I've ever heard speak.
Oh, yeah. Every day at 4 p.m. on the set, he would break out the Tootsie Roll Pops, and everybody on the cast and crew would get a Tootsie Roll Pop. And he was just a sweet, wonderful, and interesting man. So they all adored him. The kids especially adored him. And, you know, Guy and June and Mark, you know, had resentment over the fact that their roles were reduced and his was enlarged. But it didn't keep them from liking him as a person. So they really became a family. Unlike a lot of series, after they're canceled, the cast never see each other again. Lost in Space, these people got together all the time.
What a wonderful thing. I wonder, coming from Jonathan's point of view, how he felt about what was happening, the fact that he was taking over the show. I'm sure he loved the fact that he was getting all the good lines and all the good good things to do. But
well,
I mean,
you're going to hear it right from the horse's mouth in Volume 2 and Volume 3. As you saw a lot of interviews with him in Book 1, as the changes are being made, but as the dynamics of the show continue to change, and then afterwards, we have a lot of exclusive interviews that nobody's heard that have been in the can for 15 years, and they're just coming out now in these books. And he talks about it very candidly, and he felt bad about Guy Williams. There's a very touching story in the third book where Jonathan tells how he made a huge mistake with Guy one day, because he went up to Guy and he said that he felt really bad for him. He felt sorry for him because his role had been reduced so much. Well, Guy Williams was Italian-American, and he was very macho. You know, he had played Zorro. And the last thing you do is with somebody like that is to say, I feel sorry for you, because he had been trying to mask it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that caused a lot of embarrassment for him. But as I said, they all liked each other personally. And the kids especially, when you read the interviews from Angela and from Marta and from Billy, you know, over the years after the show ended, they all loved getting together for the lunches and for the conventions, because they just adored Jonathan. When you interview Billy later today, mm-hmm. we got to remember to call him Bill. Now,
he likes Bill.
Bill now, yeah, Bill. When you interview him later today, get him to do his Jonathan Harris impression.
Oh,
him
really?
And Kevin Burns both do the funniest Jonathan Harris impressions, and they do it out of total love.
Did they ever do it while he was around, Jonathan Harris?
No, but they do it now. It's like they channel him. They channel him. Oh, dear. Oh, the pain. And I can't do it, but they do it. And get Bill to do it. Well, Bill will just do it anyway, whether you ask or not, because any time he starts telling a story about him and Jonathan, he just starts doing the voice.
Yeah, I'm getting shivers just thinking about talking to them, because, you know, it's just it's so much a part of my childhood. When I hear the voice, it instantly takes me back to my childhood, and that's what a great feeling that is for anybody. As long as you had a good childhood, that is.
Yeah, and he invented that character. Because in the when the show first went on, as I said, Dr. Smith was very straight, very dapper.
Oh, yeah. The pilot, he has no personality in the pilot.
Yeah, and well, he has a personality, but it's a dark personality.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but he has no vibrant personality like he does later on. You know,
but you see his quotes in Book 1 as he realized that he was going to be killed off, and he thought, I want to stay on the show. This is a good paycheck I'm getting. It's a great role.
Yeah.
And so he started sneaking in humor bit by bit to where by the time you get into the halfway into the second season, it's very prominent. But he kind of did it episode by episode, just kind of...
Well, whose idea was it to, for all the names for the robot? Whose idea was that?
That was him, and mostly him. But Tony Wilson was the story editor on the show and associate producer, and Tony did all the rewriting of the scripts. So you had all the freelance writers turning in the scripts, and then Tony would polish them up. And he and Jonathan would get together, and Jonathan would scribble all over the script and say, change this line and change that line. I will not say it this way. Dr. Smith would say it this way. And so Tony just went along with it, and he would start rewriting the dialogue.
Oh,
so that's why I say Jonathan Harris created that amazing character, unlike any character we've ever seen on television before. He's as unique as, say, Leonard Nimoy's Mr. Spock on Star Trek.
I love the scene in the plant episode with Judy, where she's taken over by the plants, where they're going to throw Jonathan or Dr. Smith, all, you know, they're going to leave him behind, and she says, "I think it's cruel," and you know, she feels totally sympathetic toward him. I mean, he the women seem to love him. I mean, they were so, the women characters on the show, that is, but it's,
and the kids did too. And you know, and this is interesting, David. You know, when I was watching that show, as I said, an 8 year old, I guess I was. You know, he was a very dark character when the show first premiered, but even in those episodes, I liked him, and I should be embarrassed to admit that because he was a bad guy, but there was something about him that was likable, and here's what it is, and I can tell you this as a writer and a screenwriter, is even with your villains, you have to try to find a way to make the audience empathize with them. Otherwise, they're just one-dimensional. They're just the bad guy. But if you want to make them a three-dimensional character, you got to find a way to get the audience to empathize with them. So, okay, they're doing bad things, but you see the desperation in them.
Mm-hmm.
And when we see a character who's desperate, who's scared to death, who's trying to get back to Earth, who's trying to deal with these monsters, who's trying to deal with whatever he's dealing with, even though we know he's not a good guy, we
he's very self-centered. Very self-centered.
Yeah. Yeah, we can relate to him. So that was the talent that Jonathan Harris had, that he could play a bad guy, but play it as a full three-dimensional character. Now, you look at the movie that they did in the 90s, the late 90s, and the guy who played Dr. Smith. Famous actor. He played Sid Vicious in Sid and Nancy. I can't think of his name at the moment, but
Gary something.
He was just completely unlikable. I mean, there was nothing about him that you liked. And then you look at Jonathan Harris's take on the character, even in the early episodes. And there's something about him that when you saw a special guest star, I remember as a kid thinking, oh, I hope this isn't the last time we're going to see him. Because you know? I realized he was so good, just like the robot. And by the way, when we mentioned a few minutes ago and you asked me about who got the most fan mail, and I said the robot, we can laugh about that. But, you know, the robot was a real character. I
mean, well, he practically was a real person, yeah.
Bob May, you know, inside that robot. And when you watch those episodes, look at how talented Bob May was. First of all, to be inside this machine, and yet he could, he's talking, he knows all the dialogue, he's got a little key in one of his hands that he presses, this little key that makes the light on the chest plate flash on and off to coincide with the dialogue he's doing. He's spinning round and round. He's moving. He's making his bubble lift because he said, "Well, I've got no face, so I've got to find a way to make the robot have reactions." And so it was his idea to kind of lift his head up and make that bubble shoot up in the air, and wiggle the arms and do all the things he was doing to give that robot the personality and the character that it did. No wonder we fell in love with it. It was a real character.
Exactly. Now, let's talk about some favorite episodes. I think one of my favorites was There Were Giants in the Earth. That's the one that really stays with me to this day. I mean, that giant in the episode is just phenomenal. I mean,
yeah, that was a very famous football player who was inside that costume, and you see his picture in the book. With he's got the head off, so you can see what he really looks like. Lamont,
yeah, exactly.
Last name. Yeah, I think he was on the Rams, and so you know, and they shot all that stuff out in Red Rocks, where the Jupiter 2 crash lands, where the chariot's driving around, and it looked like an alien world. I mean, just the rock formations were so interesting. Yeah, that was one of the early episodes. I think that was the fourth episode.
Yeah. What a great, just a great episode. I mean, and
tremendous.
Now, what was this about? There was a scene that was cut out with Guy Williams where he was flying around.
Yeah. Yeah, the pictures are in the book. You can see them. When he's using his jetpack and he's flying around and he encounters the Cyclops giant, and he's using his laser gun to shoot at it and everything, and the giant reaches out and grabs him and holds him in his hand. And you see pictures in there of the little miniature him. It was like a G.I. Joe doll circling the giant. And then you see a picture of Guy Williams actually being held by this giant hand as he's aiming the gun at it. And that was one of the scenes that was shot that didn't get into the final episode.
Between that one and the one where they make... There's that machine that makes a lot of Dr. Smith. I forget. I don't know what episode that's called.
Space Destructors from the third season.
That was a brilliant
episode. And when you get book three, there are a lot of pictures in there of Bill, and he was Billy then, Billy Mumy going through the whole makeup process. They had to put a living mask on Jonathan Harris. And then put that on Billy and make him up. It took 4 hours each day, and all the extras that were wearing them, all the cyborgs that he made out of that machine, and they all had Dr. Smith's face, was really very adventurous for that time. I mean, nobody had ever done anything like that before, and so for the studio to be able to put that many makeup people on the job, and John Chambers, who did the faces for Planet of the Apes, was the guy who was creating all that stuff. And there's pictures of him in the book putting the applications on Billy Mumy and everything else. It's a lot of fun.
Some of the later episodes were kind of silly, especially, you know, one that really irked me was that one with the Mexican guy. Oh, I hated that episode. It was just, I don't think anybody liked that episode.
No, I haven't come across anybody who liked the episode, but one thing I do like about it is the makeup. I mean, he was all silver, and there was that Ice Princess who was Miss Universe from the year before, and the makeup that they put on her.
That was so really Miss Universe?
Miss Universe. Really? And so visually, the episode is a marvel to watch, but it's pretty insipid beyond that.
I kind of like the one with the force field and the one that takes over, the one with the spiked head, Francine York.
I interviewed her for the book.
Is she still alive?
Oh, yeah. She does a lot of the conventions, and she's still beautiful.
Really? You
know? Yeah. And I've interviewed Bettina Marcus, who is the green-skinned woman.
Yeah, whose idea was her? I wonder who brought her to life. It's a very interesting character.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was the year that everything went green. That was the second season, 1966-67, and that was the year Star Trek premiered. So on Lost in Space, we see her playing Athena, the green-skinned woman. And on Star Trek, we saw Susan Oliver as an Orion
I didn't make that connection. How about
girl.
That?
And they were both in green. This was the year that all three networks went all color. And so the mandate on these science fiction shows was to make them as outrageously colorful as possible. And so both of these shows, without knowing the other one was doing it, featured green-skinned women, and it became kind of a little bit of a rage. As people watching on our RCA color TVs went, wow.
What's your feeling, and this is just a question, but as far as Marta Kristia and Mark Gardner, do you think there was an attraction there in real life too, as well as on the...
Oh, yeah. They adore each other.
He was married at the time, and I don't know if she was or not.
And she was engaged, and so no, there was never any hanky panky between them.
Right. No, I wasn't implying that, but I just wondered. I mean, they just seemed to have such chemistry together.
They did. They really liked each other as actors and as friends. I don't think there was any romantic intention because
right.
they were both happily involved with other people, but. both of them wanted to see those characters become romantically involved because that's how it was supposed to be. But CBS didn't want it. CBS felt that the little 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds watching the show at 7:30 at night would be uncomfortable if there were scenes of Don West and Judy Robinson kissing and
smooching. You can imagine all the letters they must have gotten for people who wanted to see it happen.
Yeah, and you know, they really even wouldn't let Guy Williams and June Lockhart touch much. You see, in the early episodes, there is a lot of physical connection between them, husband and wife. But after about halfway through the first season, they barely ever touch. And again, that was CBS. CBS felt uncomfortable. And you'll see quotes in the book from June Lockhart where she says, "This is amazing. We were married. Our characters were married, and we couldn't even touch."
I guess they were afraid, you know, how they're going to explain it to their children. The children watching.
And as she said, and I agree, it would be a great role models for children to see two parents who are physically affectionate with each other.
And you look at June Lockhart.
At that time, CBS just felt that 7 and 8 year olds would feel uncomfortable watching it and be bored by it. They wanted to get to the monsters. They didn't want to watch these two adults holding hands and smooching.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but sometimes I have so many questions in my head.
Sure, and
every time you bring something up, the questions just multiply. But I wanted to remark about June Lockhart. Every time you ever have seen that woman, she's smiled. You never see her with a frown on her face. She just seemed like she was the most beautiful. Did you have a chance to interview her at all?
I talked to June, and I didn't put any of her quotes in the book, but we had tons of archival interviews with her and everything else, so her voice is well represented in all three books. And
what was she like to speak to? I've never really heard her interviewed too much.
She's elegant, she's sweet, she's positive, she's bright. I mean, I met her at the Hollywood show last year, which I went down to meet her and Bill and Angela and Mark to ask them all for interviews and so forth. And I was just amazed because I think she's around 90. And yet
91, I think, yeah.
So beautiful and so bright and so quick-witted and so funny. And when you read a lot of the interviews from Bill and Angela from book three, talking about the reunions and getting together and everything, that, you know, they talk about her like she was a second mom to them. She used to take them to concerts. She used to do all kinds of things when they were making the show.
And you watch the show, and she's really a strong force, even though she's not in, you know, a lot, she's not in every scene. But when she is, the force of her, you know, the fact that she's going to make sure her kids are okay is always there. It's always that, you know, how dare you?
Yeah, she's a very talented actress, and you know, when they gave Maureen Robinson things to do, she did them beautifully. They all did. I mean, there was not a bad apple in the cast.
So who was the one that forgot their lines the most in all the cast?
None of them. You know, everyone I've interviewed has told me that all of them were just right on the mark.
Well, who was the goofball? Who was the goofball on the set? The one that would play pranks or jokes or?
Mark Goddard.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Every time.
he and Billy Mumy, because, you know, it wasn't Billy's idea, it was Mark's idea. Mark had quite a wild sense of humor. And one day they locked Bob May inside the robot suit because they called lunch, and everybody was leaving the set to go to lunch. And they went over and they locked him in there so he couldn't get out. And they took off laughing. I think it was a great joke. And then they came back to the set an hour later, and the robot's right where they left it in the middle of the set, and they see smoke coming out of it, and they went, "Oh my God, oh my," because there was a lot of electricity.
Oh, imagine the fear.
Power cord that went up through the foot to make all those lights work and everything else. It was enough voltage to kill you if you touched the wrong thing. And they thought, "Oh my God, we killed him." And they ran over and they opened up the thing, and Bob May is inside the robot reading the newspaper and smoking a cigar.
Amazing. The relief they must have felt after that.
Oh, yeah. They adored him. You know, everybody. And even, you know, I interviewed Judy May, Bob May's wife.
Oh, Judy May, about that.
Yeah, and after she read the first book, she called me up and she said, you know, I love it, it's a great book, my God, but she said she felt a little hurt by some of the things Jonathan Harris said. And I said, Judy, when Jonathan Harris would say these things, he wasn't being serious. He was dropping into character because Dr. Smith would always put down the robot, you bubble-headed booby, you know? And so when Jonathan Harris was being interviewed and he would talk about Bob May, he would sometimes do the same stuff in a teasing kind of a way. But when you're reading stuff on the page, you can't hear the tone of voice and you can't hear the audience laughing and things of that nature. But I told her, look, when you read some of the things Jonathan says in book three, especially when everybody was doing the conventions, you're going to know that he truly thought the world of Bob May. They were all blown away by Bob's talent, first of all.
And his
sense of duty, his devotion to get inside that suit, which was like a sweatbox, and be able to do all the things he did. They all admired him. But at the same time, they didn't relate to him all the time because he seemed to love it, and they couldn't understand how anybody could love getting inside that thing.
Exactly. There's so many memories associated with the show, different episodes that were... I love the guy who could change the weather. Oh, that was cool.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you just think of...
Space Trader episode in the last part of the first season.
And Kurt Russell got one of his early starts
on. Yeah, Kurt Russell was in an episode called The Challenge with Michael and Sarah playing his dad. And it was a terrific episode that got... And one of the things I do in the book is I use a lot of the original promotional material so you can see how CBS would promote the episodes as they first aired. And that episode got a lot of attention because Guy Williams got to do a sword fight with Michael and Sarah using sabers, like Zorro did. But they're electronic. Every time they touch, there'd be sparks and everything else. And have you seen that big picture in there of the entire set as they're doing the sword fight? You see June Lockhart off to the side watching, and
right,
all the crew surrounding them.
Yeah, I just saw
sparks
that
flying in the air. You know, it was just really, you know, getting to see Guy Williams do a Zorro type action sequence was exciting.
All right, we should tell people this book is almost 700 pages long, 696. It's a huge.
Yeah.
And in case somebody's thinking, well, it's probably only a couple hundred pages. You don't, when you see episode guidebooks anymore, they're not really as extensive. They're certainly not as extensive as yours.
They're awful. I love old TV and I love movies and
well, it shows from this book. That's
I love
sure
reading about pop culture, but whenever I would get a book on a TV show, I was so immensely disappointed because they would spend two or three pages telling you the plot of the episode, and it's like, look, I know the plot, I can watch it, I don't need this. I want to know how it was done, how it was made, why they picked this particular story, how they got around the censors on this particular issue, how much did this one cost, what were the ratings. And we put the Nielsen ratings in there for every single episode. You know, those are the type
amazing
of things I want to know. I want to know what it was like for them to be making the show.
Mm.
And so we do about 15 pages for each episode, but only one paragraph is a synopsis of the storyline, because again, you can watch the episode, but the synopsis that we put in are the original network promotional material that they would send out to stations across the country and send out to newspapers promoting each episode. So you're not only being reminded what the episode's about, but you're reading it in the words that were being used to tell people about it before it ever aired. And to me, that's fun. And then we go into the memos, and we go into the interviews, and we go into the stats, as I said, like the Nielsen ratings and everything else. And so you go through the entire experience of every single episode. And that's what I did for I Spy. That's what I did for the Star Trek books, which we won a Saturn Award for as Outstanding Literary Achievement of the Year. And Leonard Nimoy called them astounding, which I'm very thrilled by.
Oh, wow.
And so far, everybody involved with Lost in Space has been very excited about these books. As a matter of fact, Kevin Burns, who is also the executive producer of the new Lost in Space series that Netflix is making, sent this first book over to everybody involved in making that show so they could read it and understand what worked about the original series, what didn't work, which episodes were best, which ones they should kind of use as the benchmark of what they want to do with the new show, and so forth. So that always makes me feel great when I see the people who made the show responding so positively to the books.
Absolutely, yeah, it's just incredible.
And are they boring?
No, this is the book.
See, I asked you that because for your listeners, you said this first book is 700 pages, and they're thinking, oh my God, I don't want to read 700 pages, and it only covers one season. Well, it also covers Irwin Allen's early career. It covers A Voice Beyond the Sea, because all that happened before, so it leads up to Lost in Space. But reading 15 pages on each episode is fun when it's the right stuff, when it's the interviews and the memos and all that kind of information. It can be very interesting to a fan of the show. And then you watch that episode again. And that's the fun thing, is making it the book interactive with watching the series again and experiencing the series again.
Now, would you ever do the same for Voyage or Time Tunnel or Land of the Giants?
I've already written a book on Voyage Beyond the Sea, and it is, I don't know if they'll be able to put it out as one volume or not, because it's pretty big. It might be a two-volume set. There's no release date scheduled for that yet, because all the focus right now is on the Lost in Space books, with the other two coming out.
Really?
The second one will be out mid-November. The third one will be out in January of next year. They're all done. They're all written. The pictures are popped in there. It's just they're spacing them out a few months each.
What was the total amount of time you spent on all three of these books? I can't even imagine.
I started working on them in January of last year, 2015, and just finished the third one a couple weeks ago, so over a year and a half.
I mean, this is something...
About 6 to 7 months on each volume. But again, you know, they're 700 pages long, and it's a ton of research, as you've seen, pulling a lot of different elements together. So it takes a lot of time to research and write these things.
I can't even imagine. I mean, it's such a work of an amazing work. I mean, when I first got the book, I thought, well, it's probably going to just be an episode guide, and that'll be it. But I mean, I had no clue what I was getting into when I started.
We call them biographies of a television series because they're written like a biography. Like if you were going to read a book on Marlon Brando or Orson Welles or Alfred Hitchcock or somebody like that, it takes their entire life and walks you through it. Well, we do that. We treat the TV show as if it's a life entity, which really it is. It had its birth. It had its growth, and it's lived on. It's still alive today.
I should mention The Keeper. That's the only two-part episode. That's one of my favorites, too, and I'd forgotten about that. And
a brilliant episode. You just want to talk great episodes? Follow the Leader. The last episode from the first season where Guy Williams is taken over by an alien entity, and again, he plays it dark. I mean, he's just brilliant in that episode. I love... you mentioned the Antimatter Man, which was terrific. There was another one called Visit to a Hostile Planet, where they return to Earth, but they go through a time, a wormhole, which makes them land on Earth 40 years in the past, in the mid-1940s, and they're believed to be a UFO. Star Trek did an episode like that, too, called Tomorrow is Yesterday. So, that was another great one. So, no, a lot of good episodes. Here's the terrific thing, is I hadn't watched Lost in Space in decades. And when I started doing these books, I always loved it as a kid. I'd seen every episode and seen quite a few of them many times over. So, you know, I got the Blu-ray set and started watching these episodes as I'm writing about them and falling in love with them all over again. And finding out that there are a lot of episodes that I actually dismissed it when I was a kid, I can watch now and get so much more out of them.
Well, here's some questions. As the show went into the third season, and we had the Vegetable Rebellion, silly episodes, you might say. Some of them were very silly. Why was that? And why was the show canceled? And did they have a plan to get them back to Earth at the end of the series? Was there a plan to do that?
Well, that's two questions. I'll answer both of them. The Great Vegetable Rebellion was one of the last episodes they shot in the third season. And
very silly episode.
A lot of people say it's the worst episode of the series or the silliest episode of the series. TV guys... Guide picked it as one of the 100 greatest episodes in the history of television. I watched it. I had such a good time watching this episode.
Why?
Especially where the colors are so just, they come alive. It's funny. It truly is funny, and the makeup is amazing as Jonathan Harris starts to
turn into metamorphosis a tree.
And turn into Dr. Smith turns into a stalk of celery.
Oh right, yeah,
it's hysterical. Now you got to watch that episode the same way you would watch something like Alice in Wonderland. You know, if you're a science fiction purist. And you love Star Trek and you love the first season of Lost in Space that was more serious, you can look at an episode like that and dismiss it very quickly. But if you're open to fantasy and you're open to the imagination that can come along with fantasy, watch that episode again, and there are a lot of amazing things going on.
I wonder what the cast thought about that episode.
They were laughing through the entire thing. Jonathan Harris loved it because he got to turn into a stalk of celery. And by the way, it's done very, very well. He looks creepy in that thing. And Stanley Adams looks ridiculous as the talking carrot, but Stanley Adams thought it was funnier than anything. He loved doing it. The others were laughing all the way through the production because they thought it was so absurd. But they loved Jonathan so much that, you know, they would just look at him in the stalk of celery thing and break up laughing. They thought it was terrific. And they had a llama in that, a real llama, who was nibbling at Jonathan Harris's crotch when he was the stalk of celery. And Harris said, "I cannot work with that beast." And so they had to take it out and replace it with a human in purple makeup. It was a purple llama. So the episode actually had a lot of problems when they were trying to film it. Now, but the second part of your question, you asked about why did the show get canceled. It was renewed for a fourth season. And they were writing scripts for the fourth season, and everybody left for a summer hiatus expecting to come back. And then suddenly they find out that the show's been canceled. And nobody ever knew why. This was another thing I like to do when I write these books is turn over every stone and find out the mysteries and the answers behind what happened. And I don't know if I should tell you, because that's in book three. Maybe I should make you wait, and we'll do another interview after you read book three.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But there really there is a reason, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just like...
Well, now you got me really curious. I'm going to have to wait till January to find out now.
Well, if I may digress for a moment, but it all pertains, it's all relevant. You know, I did this book on I Spy. I Spy was a huge hit, and it only lasted for three seasons. And Robert Culp and Bill Cosby never understood why it got canceled. They were told the ratings suddenly went down. But I get in, and as you know from looking at this book, I'll get the ratings reports for every episode of each show that I write about from Nielsen. And the ratings were actually very good, and the reason I Spy got canceled is because, one, it was too expensive, and two, Sheldon Leonard, who was the producer, got into a fight with NBC over another show, and so he said, you know, if you don't put that show on the air as you promised, I'm going to stop making I Spy. Well, he wasn't going to tell Culp and Cosby that. He wasn't going to say, I'm pulling the plug on our hit show. So what he told them is, well, the ratings have dropped off and the network doesn't want to continue. He didn't tell them the truth. And they believed that for 40-something years. And when I wrote the book, they were both stunned to find out the truth. And it made sense to them. But Bob Culp, he called me up and he said, I was depressed for a week because I realized that for 40 years I've been telling people wrong information. But you proved it. You've got all the documents in here, and now I know why our show got canceled. So I was depressed for a week, but now I feel great because I know we were a hit.
Exactly.
Well, the same thing with Star Trek. It got canceled after 3 years, and NBC let out this information saying that it was doing bad in the ratings. And everybody believed it. And for 45 years, that's all you heard was Star Trek didn't do well on NBC. Well, we got the Nielsen ratings for every episode, and we put them in those books. And it was NBC's top-rated Thursday night show. They moved it to Fridays. It was their top-rated Friday night show. Why were they trying to cancel it? Because they weren't getting along with Gene Roddenberry, and Star Trek was doing stories that they didn't want to be told on their network. Not back then, when the mandate in the 1960s was only the news division could talk about Vietnam and racism and sexism and religion. And Gene Roddenberry was writing scripts about all these things. And so they said, you got to stop. And he wouldn't stop. So they said, we got to get the show off the network. The ratings are all in these books. Okay. The same thing with Lost in Space. When you get volume 3, you're going to see it's still a hit. It's a hit show. Why would it go off? Then you'll get into the chapter about what happened.
Now, will volume 2 and volume 3 have the same cover? They have different covers.
No, they all have different covers, but they kind of tie together. The color scheme is the same, so all three of them can sit right next to each other on a bookshelf, and they all kind of look like they match the same way with my Star Trek books. They make a nice three-book set.
Well, we should tell people, can they get them on Amazon, or where can they get them?
Oh, sure. The first one came out in August, and you can get it on Amazon.com. I don't think it's in Barnes & Noble yet. The bookstores are usually a few months late in getting these things. They put in their orders.
Do you think it will be in Barnes & Noble sooner or later?
Oh, sure. I hope it's in there before Christmas, but it's certainly available on Amazon. The best place to get these is direct from the publisher, because those come autographed. And they're also a couple dollars cheaper because you're cutting out the middleman. So if you want to get them from the publisher, you can just go to JacobsBrownMediaGroup.com and you can order any of their books, including my Star Trek books or the Lost in Space books. They come autographed, and you'll save a couple dollars in the process.
Now, the one other question I asked you was whether did they ever plan to get them back to Earth?
No. Because if they had done that, and same thing with Gilligan's Island and shows like that, then it kind of makes it difficult to do the reruns, because they want the show to keep rerunning as it's been set up. Now, with Gilligan's Island, they later did a reunion movie where they got them rescued. And then at the end of the movie, I thought it was a wonderful, wonderful, brilliant thing they did. At the end of this movie, it was called Return to Gilligan's Island, I think, or Rescue from Gilligan's Island, or something like that. And it's been 15 years since the show got canceled. They're all 15 years older, and they finally get rescued. At the end of the movie, they decide they're missing each other. They've been together on this island for more than 15 years, and they're missing each other. The Howells went back to being millionaires, and the skipper got a new boat and everything. So they all decide to have a reunion and get back together and go on a cruise. And they go out on a cruise, and they hit a storm, and they end up on the same island. So they rescued them, and then they shipwrecked them again at the end of the movie, which I thought was just a brilliant way to handle the situation.
I should mention one other episode, All That Glitters. That's the one. I love the music in that one. The music in that one is particularly...
And that's the one where Dr. Smith, because he was always into riches and gold and everything, he gets to put this ring around his neck, this alien ring, that allows him, everything he touches turns into platinum. So it's kind of a takeoff on the old King Midas.
Yeah, exactly.
And he realizes he can't eat, because he goes to pick up a piece of food and it turns into platinum. And so he banishes himself from the family. And it was really a touching moment, because here's this character who's always just thinking of himself. But he's saying, no, don't come near me. I can't touch you. So he goes off to die, because he knows he can't eat and he can't drink, because even the water turns into platinum. So that he's doomed himself. I'm doomed.
Yeah.
And he goes off, and Penny comes to find him, and she comes up and reaches out to him, and he goes, no, don't touch me. And she touches him, and she turns into platinum. And it's so touching to see the self-loathing that the character goes through after that, thinking that he's killed this wonderful, sweet girl.
Well, and then we get to see that he really did care about Penny. I mean, he wasn't just a total monster. There was a human side to him.
So, I mean, that's why you remember the episode. You may not remember every little moment of it, but something about that episode got under your skin, got into your heart, and it's because of that wonderful ending and the terrific performance by Jonathan Harris, when he's just distraught over over what he's done to Penny. It's so touching. I mean, watch it. Put it on tonight. Watch that thing.
Exactly. Actually, I have every episode, but they're all on VHS. I don't have them on DVD, so I can't really watch them.
The Blu-ray set, which Bill and Angela will talk about happily, I'm sure, and they got a very nice book out, too, a picture book they did.
Hey, that's the one we're going to talk about today, yeah.
Yeah. The Blu-ray set is not that bad. It's maybe $100 with shipping.
You know what? I saw one of them for like $87 or $78.
Yeah, that sounds more like it. Yeah, but when you put in shipping and tax and everything, it might creep up towards $100. But here's the thing. You get all three seasons remastered. They just look great. Even the black and white is so crisp and beautiful. The color episodes are so vibrant. There's tons of bonus materials, including commentaries where Bill and Angela and Marta and Mark Goddard got together and watched the episodes, and you can play it with their commentary as they're laughing and they're having fun and they're remembering everything. And a bunch of the episodes you can watch with the original commercials in them from 1965 and 66 if you want to. If not, you can press a button and the commercials won't come up. I love watching them with the commercials.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. So, I mean, you know, for $90 or whatever it's going to cost you to get this thing, I think it's worth having and worth keeping.
Is it true that Red Skelton had partial ownership of Lost in Space?
Yes, he did. Yep. He owned...
Did anybody else famous own it? I mean, any other stars?
No. It was Red Skelton owned 25%. This guy named Guy Del Capi, I think his name was pronounced, owned 25%. And Irwin Allen owned 50%.
Which is why we didn't see them on TV for a while.
Yeah, CBS did not own it, nor did 20th Century Fox. CBS had the broadcast rights to it, and 20th Century Fox had the distribution rights, so they even made money after the show.
So who's got the rights now? Is it?
It's all reverted back to the owners of the Irwin Allen estate, which Kevin Burns is the shepherd for Lost in Space, and he's an amazing man. He's an amazing producer. Look him up on the internet. He's got over 1,000 credits as a producer.
Wow.
He produced all the A&E biography shows, those one-hour biography specials
right. That
they did on Arts and Entertainment. He did all that stuff and so much more, so a very talented man. Well, he was selected by Irwin Allen's estate to be the shepherd for all of Irwin Allen's properties, and he's the one who's responsible for getting Lost in Space back into production as a new series for next year.
Wow, that's going to be amazing. I can't wait to see what they do with it. Let's hope
they
do
something.
Yeah,
because he loves the show. So I think he's going to take care of it. I think, you know, it's going to be freshened up, obviously. It's going to be more like the early first season of the original Lost in Space, which most fans, and I can tell you like best.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So a little more serious. There'll be little touches of humor, but more serious.
But you look at the nighttime scenes on Lost in Space, the early episodes, and they're really creepy.
Yeah, they are. It was beautifully filmed. I think we're going to get a show that the original fans can watch and yet younger viewers can watch, and it will be relevant and feel new and feel appropriate.
I have so many questions. We have to call it quits in a minute, but just because we're taking, it's been such a wonderful time to do this. How many shows did Irwin Allen direct himself of the 83?
I think just the pilots.
Just the why wouldn't he do any others?
Well, he was so busy. I mean, he was the most successful producer in television at that time. He had three shows running simultaneously.
He was the Shonda Rhimes of his time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even Quinn Martin only had two running simultaneously. Now,
the Invaders was one, right?
Fugitive, 12 O'Clock High, then later The Invaders. But he only had two running at the same time.
So are you going to do...
Irwin had three.
Are you going to do a book on Land of the Giants?
I don't know.
Please.
One on Voyage.
I want one.
As I said, I don't know when that's going to come out. Probably next year sometime. We'll see, because there's so many things I want to write about. It takes me a year to write one of these.
Oh, I'd love to see Atlanta the Giants one. That's my favorite.
Anything I do write about is going to be to the degree of this. If you take a look at the Star Trek books or the iSpy book, it's their
wouldn't you want to do Land of the Giants?
I would enjoy doing books on all parts of Irwin Allen's career. I find him such an interesting character in his own right, and he was such a television pioneer. I mean, even Land of the Giants, you look at that for 1969 when that premiered, or I'm sorry, 68, when it premiered, I mean, to be doing split-screen photography like that and those giant props for television, I mean,
amazing.
It's remarkable what he was able to do. Now, unlike Gene Roddenberry, Irwin didn't care about making political statements and social commentary, and so that's why a lot of Trekkies will look down on Lost in Space, because it wasn't as serious as, say, Star Trek was, but there were a lot of great morality tales told on Lost in Space. It was told with great imagination, with great flair, and Orson Welles was the king of special effects for that period, and continued in motion pictures with Poseidon Adventure, Towering Inferno, just amazing movies.
Mark, you're just a fount of information. I mean, you're so fascinating to talk to. I could talk for 5 hours about this show.
Well, we'll do 5 hours spread out over five shows.
Yeah.
when you get book two and you read that, let's talk again, and we'll do it again with book three. And
absolutely.
By the time you're done with that, maybe the Voyage book will be out.
Yeah, exactly. And then you'll do Land of the Giants, hopefully. Let's cross our fingers. That would really be special. The book, again, is called Lost in Space, Irwin Allen's Lost in Space, Volume 1, by Mark Cushman. It's out from Jacobs Brown Press. And it's available.
JacobsBrownMediaGroup.com is where you can get autographed copies. Or if you can't remember that, just go to Amazon.
Is it on Amazon even as we speak?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good, good. Absolutely. Wonderful. Thank you so much. This has been a delight, more than I can ever tell you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. I'll look forward to the next time.
Yeah, and this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.